Hi there, fans of short film, and welcome to another edition of In the Green Room with me, Nigel Morgan. Back in May, we spoke to Justin S. Lee, the director of the short film Drone, which tells the story of a rookie drone pilot who comes to realize that his targets are more than just dots on a screen. The film came about at an interesting time as debates about the morality of the drone program were becoming more contentious in the United States. It also happened to land on our platform via one of our reviews, at a time where politics in America is more divisive than any time in recent memory. Justin Lee spent some time speaking with me about developing an appreciation for opposing perspectives by growing up as an outsider in Taiwan and seeing his Native America from the outside, and how it all played into how he decided to tell this intriguing and thought-provoking story. He was also kind enough to share some stories about working with Michael Trucco and Daniel Sharman on the film, and getting involved with a program that led to him directing James Franco and Eric Roberts. Have a listen and enjoy.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
So, yeah, so tell us a little bit, firstly, about your background. Your website says you spent some time in your childhood in Taiwan and and felt a little bit like an outsider there, not being able to speak the language and so on. So how did that shape your experiences?
Well, to kind of give you the full background, I was actually born in Pennsylvania, and then I was kind of raised there until I was seven. And then for the next 7 years, my family moved to Taiwan, so I went with them. And then about from high school on, I kind of spent the rest of my time in California. But I think it was like growing up was kind of a strange time for me, because in Taiwan, I went to an American school and everybody spoke English, and a lot of the teachers were American and they didn't like you speaking Mandarin because a lot of them couldn't speak Mandarin. So I kind of grew up for about 7 years in this city in Taipei where, you know, I spoke English at home, spoke English at school, and then my Mandarin was really poor and didn't really get better, in my opinion. So outside of school, on the streets, you know, at restaurants and stores, the kind of concept of kind of communicating with them was a little bit foreign to me. Like, it was strange. Like, it didn't become super obvious until I visited the States with my older brother, and who didn't grow up in Taiwan. And we were like at a store, like shopping for shoes or something. And I was like really shy and like didn't want to ask the person for a different shoe size. And my brother was like, "What the heck's wrong with you, man? Like, why don't you ask the question?" And then it made me kind of realize I had like a really different experience. And it took me a really long time to figure out that that's probably why I got into filmmaking, because I didn't really get a chance to express myself too often, aside from just hanging out with friends. So in Taiwan, I watched a lot of movies. There was only like two English channels back then. Like, TV's gotten so much better now. There was like an HBO Asia that I watched all the time, and like some other channel. And those were like my only channels for movies. So I had to watch like a lot of DVDs and stuff. And then I got really into writing growing up. And at that time, kids are so lucky these days. Like, you know, growing up, I'm sure you had the similar experience too, that, you know, there's not a lot of like film or screenwriting classes. Like, some kids these days in LA get film classes in high school or middle school. And I think that's super awesome. But for me, I wasn't exposed to that until really late. So with this desire to express myself and wanting to, you know, write, I just wrote in whatever medium was exposed to me through classes, you know. So that was basically just creative writing, like fiction. You know, I tried to write short stories, a little bit of poetry. And then in high school, when I moved to California, I went to like a school in Arcadia, which is like a very Asian kind of city. I got into journalism. And then it wasn't until about the end of high school and the beginning of college when I finally took a film class and a screenwriting class. And then once I was exposed to that, I knew that was the medium of the stories that was in my mind the entire time of my life. But because I was never exposed to it, I mean, it seems obvious, like in retrospect, because now all my friends that know that I'm in film now, they all say, "Oh yeah, like you were the guy that, you know, was watching movies all the time and stuff." But because I was never exposed to the medium, I never knew that was the right form of storytelling for me until I actually was exposed to it. And once I took my first screenwriting class, and then did my first short film in college, I knew that's like what I had to do, so I caught the bug. I was at UC Berkeley at the time studying business, and then knew I wanted to do film, and Berkeley has a great film theory program, but not that strong of a film production program, so I took as much film theory classes as I could for kind of just that foundation, and then I took a year off after college to kind of work in the industry, did a couple of internships and stuff, and then after that I went to USC Film School for the grad program. Graduated there like last year, or maybe it's like a year and a half now, or even longer, and now I'm just, you know, working the grind and breaking into the biz, hopefully.
So, you know, it's kind of going back to your childhood a little bit. How do you think that shapes your perspective in what would eventually manifest itself in filmmaking?
You know, it's interesting. It's in some way, you know, a lot of this is like very meta. Like, none of these were conscious decisions, but even like thinking about it now, I think a big part of my perspective or my point of view, it helps the fact that I lived outside of America for a really long time. So, you know, in good ways and bad, but it's like spending 7 years of your kind of like key adolescent years, like in a different country. I think, I don't know if it makes you, it's just like a different perspective. Like a lot of the friends I grew up with had very different points of view, and that kind of opens your mind up a little bit. It makes you think about, you know, the other side of things perhaps. And so I don't know if it was more that, or maybe just going into like a school like Berkeley, which is like, you know, very liberal and open-minded. That kind of made me change my perspective on things. It's really easy for me to see the other side of things. So I think with Drone, for example, you know, I think that's a great film that I was tasked a lot. Like a lot of my crew and like people who believe in the project, like kept going up to me and they're like, you have to pick a side, like, thematically, you know, or message wise. And, in a way I kind of completely disagreed with that. And that's not, you know, hopefully when people watch it, that's not the approach we went with, but it's a very open, I think, open-minded kind of film that kind of shows hopefully both sides of things. And I think growing up in another country for about like 7 years, you know, and going to kind of schools like Berkeley, which is really open-minded, it kind of like helps you kind of see that other side of things. So I didn't really kind of realize that until now, just talking with you about it, but that's probably added to like, you know, what we were able to accomplish with Drone.
How did you come to then collaborate with Tony Rettenmeier, who wrote the script? Was he coming from that kind of perspective as well?
Yeah. So this class is interesting because it was done through a class at USC. The class is called 546, and it's kind of this, it's kind of like USC's film program's flagship production class. And it's really special because if you're fortunate enough to get selected to be a part of it, they kind of finance the film. And you get like really awesome faculty mentorship, that kind of guide you through beginning to end. And the class is interesting because it's like really competitive. It's like a multi-round selection process. So the way I met Tony was, when you first apply to it, there's a kind of separate group of screenwriters who apply, a separate group of directors who apply, and a separate group of producers who first apply. So producers send in their resumes, screenwriters submit like a really early draft of their scripts, and then directors submit like their reels. And then there's like a first round cutoff where, you know, I forgot how many submissions, but it's, you know, the whole school, all the graduate students, they all apply. And then after the first round cutoff, there's, you know, I'm going to get these numbers a little bit mixed up, but let's say there's like, you know, 20 or 30 scripts that are selected in the first round, and then about like 20 or 30 directors. And then, you know, there might, you know, actually it's a little bit less than that. And then there's about like 30 producers. And once those are all kind of, once all those people pass the first round, those groups all then have to meet in person. And then there's kind of this really funny, like it feels like awkward speed dating or something. Cause then all those people have to meet up, and then the faculty is like, okay, now you have to pair up into trios, you know? And then there's only, there's not enough for everybody. So like, if let's say there's like 20 scripts and 20 directors, there might be like 30 producers or something like that. Or there might be 30 scripts but only like 15 directors, you know? So it's kind of like weird. And I've been on the other end of that, because when my first second or third semester, I had my script in as a writer, like a different script. And then in the meeting, like, you know, it's really clear when like directors and producers like go to the hot screenwriters, and then it's like really sad because then some of the screenwriters who maybe it didn't respond well to those people, they kind of just like get ignored, and it's like really awkward, and you just like stand there with your friends being like, oh, I wasn't the loved one. So that happened, but with Drone, you know, I read the script of Drone. It's a very different early draft, but I thought it had a lot of potential and I loved it. So you know, I got like pizza or something with the writer and met him for the first time, and when we sat down and talked about it, I think we clicked really right away. Like, we love the same movies, we're big fans of sci-fi. You know, even it's so funny, like, you know, this isn't a sci-fi movie at all, right? Cause it's so everything's realistic for today, but it's like it does kind of have a sci-fi feel to it, and then it's, I think it even got programmed in the sci-fi section once, which I thought was kind of funny. But you know, we both loved sci-fi films, and then what really blew me was like Tony handed me a article, which was a big inspiration for us from GQ. It was featuring a drone pilot. Back then, a couple more people have kind of spoken out, but this was basically the first retired drone pilot in the United States Air Force who basically came out and spoke about his experiences, which at the time was really frowned upon. The whole program was really top secret. I mean, it still is, but it was extremely top secret back then. And so he got in a lot of trouble speaking out about his experiences. Like, a lot of his close friends, they were all, you know, harassing him on the internet and stuff. But he spoke to this journalist, and this journalist did a great GQ article write-up about his experiences. And his name is Brandon Bryant, and then the pilot. And so when I read the article, I thought it was amazing, and then I kind of, you know, shared with Tony my kind of take on where we could, you know, push the script even further, and he seemed really open to it. So we agreed to kind of pair up, and then we met a great producer named Abby Corbin, who also is a director now, and team. And then the next scary process, this all happens in the course of like 1 or 2 weeks. You then have to like develop a new draft and then develop pitch material. So we had like a pamphlet of like pictures and all that, and then we pitched to the faculty of the program. There were like, I don't know, like 10 or 15 faculty, and there's this kind of really scary pitch where you're standing up in front of all of them, you basically pitch it. And then because they kind of structure the program like a studio, so they want you to kind of get the studio pitch experience.
Okay.
So when we did that, then the same day, that afternoon, they only select 3 of all the projects. And so they email you at the end of the afternoon. So we got the email, we were super happy. And after that, that's when you crew up. That's when you start to, once you're officially selected as one of the 3 per semester, you start to crew up and kind of fully get your entire crew, DPs, editors, you get another producer. And so once we kind of got fully staffed, then the next semester we started shooting, and then, you know, eventually finished it.
Fantastic. I mean, it's a huge sort of logistical undertaking, particularly for a short film. Yeah. Is it the size of project that's typical for USC and this kind of program, or was it out of the ordinary?
In this kind of program, I think I will have to admit it was like very, very, very ambitious. You know, some of the producers that I was talking to were like, yeah, like, you know, at the time, they don't know which projects you're interested in and stuff. And they're like, yeah, you know, I'm down to produce every project except Drone. Like, you know, some people were saying that because they knew it was super ambitious, and a lot of people were scared to kind of tackle it on. But the story was so compelling, I think everyone was willing to push, you know. But it was definitely hard to make, and definitely pushed the guidelines of the class to the max as well. Like, we had our producing instructor, John Watson, I think definitely had a fight for us, because we had to, like, a lot of things we were trying, the way we pushed visual effects and stuff. It was from that program, from that class itself, they didn't have too much of that. They had a little bit, but, like, we constantly were, you know, I don't know if getting in trouble was the right word, but there's constantly a lot of red tape and, like, you know, other faculty members, and kind of to talk about it and assuage their concerns and stuff. But fortunately, we had a great crew, you know, great producers, you know, a lot of people in the faculty really pushed for us to kind of put out those fires and let it happen. And it was great too, because I didn't know about, because I was super stressed about this stuff, so I didn't find out about a lot of these conflicts until after the film was done. So that's another sign of, like, great producing, is when, you know, they can put out fires without even you knowing. Yeah, so absolutely. It's definitely challenging. But hopefully, you know, there was another film before us that I think really did push the boundaries, and then hopefully we pushed it further, and then hopefully after that, you know, films done through this class after us are going to realize, oh, like, well, look at those films, they really pushed it, so hopefully they push it even further, you know, because I think that's the part of the challenge is how do you keep tackling on more ambitious projects and stuff. So yeah, I definitely think we pushed the envelope with this one, and hopefully, you know, they're just that the films and filmmakers from that class just keep pushing it further.
Absolutely. I mean, that your efforts obviously culminated in your Student Academy Award nomination as well. So what was the process of getting from completion to the nomination?
So film festivals finally started connecting Vimeo links, which like is totally the standard now and so much more convenient. And then that was the first year, I don't know if this had anything to do with it, but that was the first year the Student Academy Award kind of competition started accepting Vimeo links as opposed to DVDs. So we submitted to that. And then, you know, I forgot how long, but a couple months later, we just got an email saying, like, congratulations in advance to, I think either I think it started with a quarter finalist. And I was like, oh, that's great. It's like, that's like 10%, top 10% or top 5%. And then, you know, you had a couple more months of just like, you know, bated breath waiting, you know, right, to find out. We found out it got into the semifinalists, which is like 5%. And then I knew that, getting to the finalists was going to be the big achievement, because once you get there, it kind of gets blasted, like Variety and stuff. And so I really wanted that just for like press and all that. And it's really helped because people have contacted me having seen it on that list and stuff. So yeah, when we finally got the notification that I was a finalist, which I think is like top 2% out of all the submissions, that was as happy as we could be, to share that with the crew, because everyone worked really hard. I mean, it was an ambitious project, so people definitely put like their blood, sweat, and tears in it. To see that kind of, you know, get its sort of recognition was really great. And I'm sure it's helped a lot of our crew, you know, like some of our friends got visas. I'm sure in a small part, maybe a big part, but you know, for them to be able to put that on their, you know, visa applications that the project that they worked on was nominated for Student Academy Award or Student Academy Finalist or whatever you want to call it. You know, to kind of hear those stories, I think was really great.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fantastic achievement. The people you're able to get to star in, I mean, obviously you have Michael Trucco in there. You know, that's a big get. So how were you able to reach out to those types of actors?
Michael Trucco and Daniel Sharman were like huge, huge hard gets. You know, this isn't a program in that class where it's typical to get people like that. You know, you usually just cast, you know, up, you know, whatever actors come into your auditions. But, you know, there was a film before us that kind of casted higher caliber cast, so we kind of strove for that too. So glad that, you know, they pushed us. And then the story was kind of weird. It's, before I went to school, I interned on a movie called Atlas Shrugged. It's based on Ayn Rand's book, and it was a kind of an independent production. And then through that, I got really close with the director because I was like an intern, but then I was on it for so long. At the end, they were basically like, oh, we're going to give you credit as like a casting assistant, production assistant, and a post-production assistant. And so through that time, I was able to bond really close with the director, Paul Johansson. Mm. And he's, you know, an accomplished actor and also a director and a writer. And so when this project started getting going, I just contacted him again because he wrote like my letter of recommendation to USC. I was like, hey, I have this really special project. Would you mind taking a look at the script and seeing if you have any, you know, acting friends that you think are really talented or maybe kind of well-known? Because, you know, having a well-known actor always elevates your project as well. And he took a look at it, and he basically, like, I couldn't believe he did this. He just opened his old Rolodex to me. Wow. You know, he called me on the phone, and he was basically like, okay, like, who do you want? And he started, like, going down his phone and just, like, naming all these, like, famous actors and stuff. And then that's how I got Michael Trucco, because when he said Michael Trucco's name and that, you know, they worked together on, One Tree Hill. And then when I saw that name, I know him from, I was a big fan of him from Battlestar Galactica. And I was like, oh my God, he'd be perfect for the role of Hunter. And so he called him and like left a voicemail saying like, Justin's going to call you, like, you know, gave a pitch about how I think we should give back to the community or something like that. And just spoke really highly of me. And then, I was really nervous. Like, I'm not really like a cold caller type of person. Mm. And then I had to credit my producers because they're like, Justin, you have to call him. Like, just do it. You know, and like the deadline for announcing our cast is really soon because our class is really structured. So like shoot dates are all locked. And then when you, you know, our screening date is locked. So like casting had to be done by a certain time, like a week away or something. So they're like, you have to call him. So they really pushed me. Mm. And I just cold called Michael. And at that point, I wasn't even sure if Paul called Michael or not. So I just cold called him. And by the way, like all the people I was cold calling were surprisingly really friendly. Like some of these people, I think Paul didn't even get to give him a heads up on, but they would answer their phone and then I would just politely introduce myself and say, like, you know, I used to work for Paul Johansson. And they were, like, really nice. I thought some of them, I was, like, getting prepared to be, you know, like, pulled down and be like, how did you get this number, blah, blah. But they were all really nice. And some of them were like, you know, I can't do it. But, like, you know, here's another actor that's, like, up and coming that I think is looking for, you know. So some of them were, like, giving me other numbers and stuff. And then when I called Michael, he answered the phone. It was really nice. And, you know, he liked the concept. So, yeah, he told me to send him the script. And he read it, emailed me back, and said he loved the script. And we met for coffee, you know, and I think we really clicked. And he said he wanted to do it. And then he said, I have someone perfect for the role of Matt. And then he gave me Daniel Sharman's contact info. So I actually found Daniel through Michael.
Right.
And they both, I think, knew each other and wanted to work with each other. And so they both agreed to do it. And, you know, that I think once that came aboard too, I think everyone worked off also extra harder because, you know, the crew was like, oh my God, like, you have, you know, Michael Chugo and Daniel Sharman on board now. So that really pushed and elevated the project. And, you know, they're fantastic because, you know, we try to be strategic. Fortunately, the class is structured where you shoot on weekends. Mm. So hopefully it's not that big of a problem for some of these casts. Because, like, if they were to be working on something, they'd be working something during the week, you know? Mm. So that definitely helped. But I will say, like, they really went above and beyond, too. Because even for, you know, our shoot dates were a lot. But then Michael Trucco booked a TV show shoot in Canada. And it conflicted with our last day of shooting, was like his most important scene. And so he like texted me or called me and I was like, I can't make that day. And, you know, I called him right away and he's like, yeah, I knew you'd call me. And then, you know, it was like such an awkward conversation because he's doing so much for us. But then I can't switch the dates. So I was basically like begging him, I'm like, is there anything you can do? And, you know, I can't believe he did this. But Michael was like, you know what? I promised I would do this shoot for you. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to, because he's like already in Canada at this point or something. Mm. And he's like, I'm going to fly back to shoot your scene that day. And at the end of your shoot, fly back to Canada, like to continue my shoot there. And, you know, like, obviously that's outside our budget range, like something he paid for. And I can't believe he did that, you know, and I'm sure Daniel had to cancel a few engagements for us as well. So, you know, they did fantastic, really awesome people to work with. You know, I can't believe they had to cancel some things for us. And then so hopefully they're really proud of the film. I think they are, you know, they spoke really highly of it. So I just have nothing but great things to say about them and how much they're able to lend us their amazing talents.
That's fantastic. Yeah. I mean, that's serious commitment for anybody. I mean, especially, you know, somebody who has a paid gig outside the country. You know, to come back.
Yeah, yeah, you know, and then the nice thing, I guess, is, like, if you have an interesting enough project for that kind of caliber of cast, it's, like, they might do it, like, you know, and help you out, because they're interested in juicy material, and then because they're doing so well as actors, you know, money isn't as big of an issue.
How much did you intend for it to be a social statement about America as a whole, because drone warfare is very much an American thing. You know, I know America's not the only country with drones, but America's drone warfare is being very, very prevalent in world news, and it's a contentious issue in the United States. So, how much was it supposed to be a statement on America as opposed to a personal story about this one particular rookie pilot?
You know, yeah, I think it's a combination of both, you know, like, again, I don't think it was, like, an anti-American statement, but it's definitely, like, a request to get the audience to think about certain things. You know what I mean? You know, war is tricky, and sometimes you have to do certain things, you know, in war, but, you know, I think it's also important to think about the other perspective, you know, not to say that I, like, you know, support, you know, obviously I don't support terrorism and stuff like that, but when you think about certain questions, like, you know, imagine being a kid growing up in the city where drones are flying over every day and places are being bombed, you know, or just even when you look at other wars, you know, like, it's interesting to think about, you know, and I struggle with knowing whether what's the right answer or not all the time, you know, like I ask myself, like, well, you know, like, what, you know, the two atomic bombs dropping in Japan, you know, like, perhaps a necessary thing to do, but also interesting that it's, you know, America's the only country that's use nuclear weapons, right? And then so it's, you know, there's no clear-cut answer to this sort of stuff, but I think it's really important to be aware of it and, you know, ask those questions. You know, like, it's really fascinating that, like, the Vietnam War in Vietnam is called the American War, you know what I mean? And not to say one side is right or the other side is wrong, but, you know, if someone is kind of too... if someone doesn't think about that outside perspective and they're just, like, I don't know, just... hardcore just from America and hasn't really looked outside of that, they might not realize that kind of other perspective. Because, you know, Alan Watts said something really interesting. This philosopher was basically like, I forgot the exact quote, but he was, he basically said, like, every side of a war has a complete sense of self-righteousness in going to it, right? Because war is a terrible thing, and you're only going to fight in a war if you truly believe your side is correct, right? And that was a really fascinating quote to me. And I just heard that quote like this year. That doesn't mean either, both sides could be wrong, but I'm just saying it's important to realize that each side completely believes in their perspective, you know? And so I think part of what we're trying to accomplish with Drone was just to get a little bit a sense of that, you know? And also the important thing of the humanization, you know, I think, it's really tricky, and that's what we try to kind of tell in Drone, is that I think it's really important for people to make sure to remember that every side in a war, all these people are human, you know, and they have lives just like yours. It's tricky when you're a soldier, you know, or a drone pilot, and that's why, like, Hunter's character is really interesting, and that it might make their job easier, you know, to kind of treat it like a dot in the screen, but I think it's really important for, you know, just civilians to kind of remember that. And I think that's kind of changed lately, you know, that we kind of see the other side as the enemy or, you know, terrorists and just terrorists, you know, but those, you know, but the enemy in every side of war has come from some sort of perspective. And so that was really important too, I think. I think it's a dangerous... it's dangerous for society, I think, to head towards a direction where in every side of war, the other side is kind of treated like not as a human being, you know?
I think one of the key things about Drone is that rather than saying this side is right and this side is wrong, it kind of helps to or aims to shake the audience out of a partisan mindset.
Definitely.
And with things as they are in the United States at the moment, there's obviously a lot of partisan politics going on at the moment. Do you think that something like Drone is more relevant now than it was when you made it a couple of years ago?
I think so. You know, it's so tricky. Politics today, you know, it's even like, you know, not, I'm even like worried in my mind right now of like, oh my God, what am I going to say now? Because it's become so polarized to the point where people can't really completely voice their opinions, you know? And I see definitely legitimate points made from both sides, but what's happening now, similar to kind of Drone and sort of like a dehumanization, is that instead of actually listening to each other, each side is calling the other like a bigot, you know, or a racist or a sexist, you know? And sure, there are those outliers for sure on both sides probably, but I've definitely had really intelligent friends who I think are, you know, trying to have proper discourse, like, you know, on Facebook or something, or just in person, you know, be called these labels. And it's like, I don't know if that's an intentional political weapon to kind of label someone that so that they become completely disregarded. It's kind of putting like, you know, like a target on their back. But it's become really strangely polarized. We're to the point now where, you know, each side has sort of has this like mob mentality, and then it's become like trendy just to go all in on this way or all in on that way. And that kind of nonpartisan, see both sides kind of perspective that I think Drone tries to kind of share, is going away today. And I think it's really scary, like, regardless of what side you're on. It's really strange. Like, I don't think each side is talking to each other, you know. And obviously, I think a lot of the people on the left, for example, were really surprised about the number of people who like voted for Trump, you know, not saying I, you know, went this way or that way, but it's pretty interesting that everyone's so surprised about that. And that goes to show, regardless of whether or not people, you know, regardless of whether or not you believe, you know, like Trump should have been elected president, you have to acknowledge that a lot of people voted for him, you know what I mean? And so they're definitely hurting in some form or the other. And you don't want to disregard that just because they chose someone that maybe you think, and maybe you're right, that like they're not the right person, but people definitely voted for him. And so there's a lot of people who have very different political views. And then people are in such big bubbles now too, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like if you live in LA, SF, or New York, and so I always try to make, it's really strange the way I think now, like I have to like quadruple check everything that I read. During the election, you know, I watch CNN, Fox News, and like the Young Turks online on YouTube. I would watch all three at the same time. Like sometimes I would have it, one on my TV, one on my laptop, and one on my phone. And it's amazing how different politically each one is. And so it takes so much effort now. It's become so polarized. You have to, I think, in my opinion, to be truly, I mean, it's tough for me to say like truly objective, but like my best attempt to get objective information or form an objective opinion is to kind of get all perspectives of it. And it's become so polarized now where it's really hard. Like I was telling my friends, I was like, it's really draining to like now have to like quadruple check like everything you read because of that spin. But yeah, the state of affairs right now politically, it's a really tricky political climate.
I mean, that being the case, would you be more or less likely to become involved with a project or direct a film that has a political aspect to it?
I think I'd be really open to it, but it would come from a really similar sensibility to Drone in that I would kind of show both sides. I would try to, you know, I'm very against heavy-handedness. I'm all about like sharing, in my opinion, information that hopefully is semi-objective, and then letting audiences form their own opinions, you know. Because, you know, it's funny, like I think someone could watch Drone and be like, it's a necessary evil. And then someone could watch Drone and be like, oh, like let's end the drone program, you know. And to me, that's not, either opinion is not neither right or wrong, you know. I'm just like, okay, I'm glad that helped. Like my goal when we first made Drone, it was like, all I want is people to watch Drone and then go home and do some research on it, you know, for it to be an interesting topic. And for them, just like when I was exposed to the script, I was like, this is really interesting, because I knew nothing about the drone program. And this was before the drone film started getting made, like Good Kill, like the Ethan Hawke movie, and then Eye in the Sky. Like we made Drone at the same time Good Kill was made, and we actually finished Drone before Eye in the Sky,
right?
Which is funny, because because you do festivals and stuff, like shorts get this really delayed release. So when we finally put it on Vimeo, people were like, oh yeah, kind of reminds us of Eye in the Sky. And I'm like, oh, like we made it first technically. But yeah, like, you know, my sensibilities, I think, would be to kind of do the same sort of thing. I don't think it, because the country's so divided right now, whether it's 50-50 or 60-40 or whatever, it doesn't really do the country justice, I think, to tell a story with such a huge, like, politically doubled down perspective, because all you would be doing is adding fuel to that, like, 50% of your side that you already agrees with you, you know, and so the films that I would kind of do if it had any politics at all would be the type of films that reaches across the aisle.
So with the success of Drone, how big a part did that play in leading you onto the Actors Anonymous project with James Franco and Eric Roberts?
Yeah, so the Actors Anonymous feature, I have to give you some background on that, was, I think, the last project I did at USC. So it was also a USC project, which is cool. So James Franco basically had this desire many years ago to kind of give back to the community. And so he founded this company called Elysium Bandini Studios with his producing partner, Vince Javalette, and another producer named Jennifer Howell. And it's basically like an artist charity where they basically want to give back and give filmmakers, aspiring filmmakers and new filmmakers, the kind of resources that, like, James Franco, for example, did not have growing up. So they created a studio, and they started all these collaborations with film schools. I think James started at NYU, but now he does it at USC and UCLA, where basically every year he'll finance a feature film through USC, and then he will serve as directing professor, and then if he can, he'll lend his own acting talents to the movie as sort of, like, you know, a smaller role or a bigger role depending on his schedule and his interest or something. And so Actors Anonymous was a great one because it was about, I think it was like the third project he did at USC with that collaboration. And this time he gave us one of his novels. The film's an adaptation of a novel called Actors Anonymous that he wrote. It's his second novel. The first one he wrote, his first novel is Palo Alto, which was a great film, indie film. And so the second novel is basically like a Hollywood tell-all about all the names are anonymous, but you can kind of assume it's experiences that James Franco has had or his friends, and they're either famous celebrities or people who wanted to be celebrities who had never made it as an actor. And it's just a series of vignettes of just their experiences and exposing the kind of seedy underbelly of the industry. So when we adapted it, we kind of streamlined that into a mainstream narrative story that focuses around two characters. So one semester was a writing class where 8 student writers were selected in a similar kind of competitive application process as 546. So 8 writers were selected to adapt it. They wrote that script in one semester, and then next semester, 12 directors were selected through a similar application process to direct the film. So we directed that the next semester, and then in the summer we kind of finished the post. But yes, to answer your question with Drone, you know, it definitely helped. Like, the submission was like a reel based submission, so I obviously put a lot of stuff from Drone in it, and you know, that definitely helped.
How did you find it then working with somebody like James Franco and Eric Roberts as well? You know, we're talking about top tier actors
in
just about every sense there. So how was that as an experience for you as a director?
They're awesome. You know, just like how Michael Chukwu and Daniel Sharman were awesome. I was telling my acting friend the other day, actually, it's like, cause when I was really lucky to be able to work with that many, you know, accomplished actors at film school, you know?
Yeah.
But before that, you're casting, you know, just having open auditions. And I was telling my friend, cause you know, he's, you know, an actor or like trying to break in as an actor. And I was telling him, like, you know, I don't know what it is, if it's just the stardom or whatnot, but in my own personal experience, it's a night and day difference working with that caliber of actors and other actors. Just because of, you know, they're newer, like other actors are just newer. They still have stuff to learn and they don't have as much tools in their back pocket. And then, and so with these actors, it's amazing, you know, they nail it in the first 2 takes, you know, they take adjustments super well. And so it saves so much time in your production. Whereas, you know, if you're working on a student film and just casting someone who's new to acting or whatnot, maybe not yet working yet, or maybe not yet represented. In my personal experience, I don't get the take that I want until about like take 8, you know, take 10. Right. And if you imagine that for every shot, that's going to, you know, slow down your production. Not that it's like their fault or anything. It's just the nature of how it works. So working with them was great. Like working with Daniel and Michael, like they kill. It was so easy to work with them. Take one or two, they would nail it, and then adjustments would just be to shape things. And then, you know, Eric Roberts is super professional. I worked with him a lot on Actors Anonymous. Really funny guy. And like, each actor works very differently too, so it's funny kind of seeing how different Eric Roberts works. And just because of the different ways they were trained, you know, whether it's Method or Meisner. But he was really solid as well, you know, nails it really quickly. And then he's funny because, like, one thing that you're taught in film schools is, like, oh, like, never tell an actor, like, that what they just did is, like, bad or something, right? Like, you just have to, like, give them adjustment or be a little bit sneaky with that. Like, if the performance seems a little bit false, like, you know, give them business, give them, like, objects and stuff to mess around with, or tell them to walk around so that their mind is, they're not in their head, you know, and that they're just present. And so there's a funny little anecdote there where, like, there was something Eric Roberts was doing that just, like, didn't feel right. Like, it didn't feel, you know, like, not to call him, like, by no means he wasn't a bad actor at all, but, like, it just didn't feel right in that whatever he was giving him in that particular scene. And in the way I was trained, I was like, okay, how do I, like, distract him? How do I give them this adjustment and that adjustment? And he, like, none of it was making sense to him. And I was trying all these different things. And then after a couple of times, he just, like, I think he picked up on it. And he just went up to me, he's just like, Justin, if what I'm doing isn't good, you need to just tell me. And I was just like, okay, it wasn't good. And he's like, you got it, boss. And then he just did this next take, and he just killed it. And it's funny. So he worked it differently. Like, he's not the kind of actor that's self-conscious, right? So he's the type of actor where it's like, be more efficient to tell him, you know what, like, what you just gave me, like, you need to make a different set of choices. You know what I mean? And so that was a really funny example of, like, what I was taught in school was not working out at all, and then, you know, he was able to kind of just, you know, take bring it out of me. So he's really great. You know, James Franco, most of my experience working with him is him from the directing professor kind of standpoint, and he was, like, super, super smart. You know, maybe always that way to begin with, but I'm assuming also because he's worked with so many talented directors and just through osmosis of watching and learning was able to pick up on so much. But his notes from a script level and from a editorial standpoint were, like, super solid for storytelling. And then he's really unique also being an actor, because anytime he pitches you a script note or a cut note, you know, or something, he'll be able to perform it, you know, like, which I thought was, like, a unique gift that I've never kind of seen happen before at school. Because at USC, you have other directors giving each other notes, and the notes are just always conceptual. They're like, oh, well, what if this happens, or what if this and that happens? But James Franco will be able to be like, okay, so here's my note, and it'll be sort of like this. And then he'll just start performing, like, each role. Like, he'll switch voices and play both sides. Right. And then so you can really see his note executed in, like, a rehearsal kind of feel, like, right away. And then through that, like, jokes hit really well and all that. So he has a really unique gift as a filmmaker and as an actor to be able to do that. So, yeah, really smart people.
Fantastic. So did you learn anything through working with them that you were able to take forward? And if so, what was the main thing you learned from that process?
You know, I mean, there's so much I learned on Actors Anonymous. You know, just the fact alone that there are 12 co-directors, you know, directing a feature film that's not vignetted, it's not a collection of short stories. It's just literally, when you watch it, you're not supposed to tell when it switches. And so that was interesting to be able to see other directors work, you know, in a different style than you do, but hopefully achieving the same on screen, the same kind of vision. Spent a lot of time in pre-production kind of agreeing on kind of like a set of sort of rules, you know, and story structure. You know, that was just a really, really unique experience. So I love that. And then seeing other people work, learned a lot. Yeah. I mean, you know, those other directors were amazing. You know, I always feel bad, like, doing interviews and, like, talking about the project without, like, mentioning the other directors. So if anyone wants to look up who the other directors are and stuff, just check out our website, actorsanonymousmovie.com. You can kind of check out all the other directors' IMDbs. And then, you know, in terms of what I learned from James and Eric, you know, I think just, it was just another, to me, it was just another example of working with professional caliber actors and just getting an extra, I think the more you do that, the more you're going to learn, like, oh, like, it's this type of style you know, like, it's an actor who came from this kind of training, and so you have to communicate with them in this way, or it's this kind of personality, so you have to kind of treat them that way. So it just kind of gave me more experiences with that to deal with, so I have hopefully like a bigger paintbrush now. You know, I feel like Michael Chugo and Daniel Sharman, for example, they worked really similarly. Maybe it's because they both came from TV, so it was like I was much more used to working with them, and then to work with the cast on Actors Anonymous, there were different acting styles, different personalities and stuff, so that was kind of interesting to have to like go back and forth. And you really do. I mean, I've heard that in interviews from directors, and I never really experienced it until Actors Anonymous, where you literally have to kind of shut down a different style of directing or change a different style of directing depending on which actor you're talking with, which is kind of interesting. Yeah.
Okay. So what's next for you in terms of projects?
So in terms of projects, the thing, so after finishing Actors Anonymous, I wrote a feature script, a sci-fi spec called Reduct. So we have that out my reps took out. And then I'm about like a month away from finishing a pilot spec, also sci-fi. It's called, I haven't really told anyone the name yet, but it's called Generation Arc. And I think the goal for my reps, hopefully, fingers crossed, is they're going to take it out and try and use it as a sample and show it to any currently existing shows that are kind of similar in the genre, and if they like the writing, try and get me staffed as a TV show, on the TV show as like a writer. Mm-hmm. So, you know, give you some background, when I got representation, their strategy with me was to start me off in the industry as a writer and then transition back to directing, hopefully after you've like established good working relationships with producers and stuff. And that all made sense to me. Like, a lot of the filmmakers that I'm trying to think of like recent breakout directors, like Alex Garland, who did Ex Machina. Like, I love that film. He for Danny Boyle a lot, and like did some great films, like wrote great films like Dread and stuff. So he was started as a writer. I think even Damien Chazelle, you know, who's like the youngest director to win an Academy Award, I think. He started off writing a lot as well. I think he even co-wrote like 10 Cloverfield Lane, you know, which a lot of people don't know about. So that seemed like a really practical strategy. I did think about kind of doing the like, okay, now it's time to do an independent feature film and like max out my credit cards or do a Kickstarter or ask all my friends and family for money. But then the strategy that these guys mentioned, I mean, to each his own, you know, everyone has a different strategy, but that made the most sense to me. And I also like writing. I enjoy writing a lot. And like I told you, when I was growing up in Taiwan, like I started as a writer first. And so, starting that way made sense to me, and hopefully it works out. You know, we'll see in the next couple of months. Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, certainly look forward to seeing the next project, and definitely hope that that everything pans out on the spec front as well. Sounds very exciting, and a very remarkable journey from internships to programs at USC to where you are now. So absolutely fantastic work.
I think this is my first podcast, so hopefully it was cool. I had a really great time. I think we covered a lot of ground. So thanks so much, Nigel.
No problem. Thank you.
That was Justin S. Lee, director of Drone. Well, that's all we have time for in this edition. If you want to find out more about Justin Lee, you can head over to his website, justinslee.com. You can also see his work on vimeo.com/JustinSLee. Don't forget to head over to cameolaunch.com/news to read our review on Drone and many more films from across the online landscape. You can also sign up for our mailing list and get updates and alerts on new films, reviews, podcasts and more. And if you're an iPhone or iPad user, you can download the Cameo Launch app from the App Store and get access to our featured short films, digital magazine and lots more exciting content. Thanks for joining us for In the Green Room, and I look forward to catching you all next time. Take care.